We're starting an afternoon session. This is Jane Blewett, and we're going to do a session this afternoon on ecofeminism. And I begin with a bit of an apology because I didn't come fully prepared to do this. I have some materials, some notes, and it's an area I want to do a lot more work in. So in a way, this is just putting out some beginning feelings or some beginning comments about it. What I thought might be helpful, though, is even before I say what I understand ecofeminism to be, to just talk a little bit about the kind of the streams of feminism that most of us would sort of recognize. And I really invite others in this circle. There are many of you who can add to this and complement it in lots of different ways. That there are, you know, there are thrusts in the feminist movement that have kind of their own identification. And let me just put those out a little bit and then move on from there to ecofeminism. First of all, I would say the first kind of stream I'd identify by the name of liberal feminism. Liberal feminism. And these are women who take kind of as their axis of analysis the political legal arena. And they talk the language of rights very strongly, that the demand to have rights. And trace that back, well, you can go far back, but even in kind of, within the American experience, as early as 1792, a woman by the name of Mary Wollstonecraft wrote an article called On the Vindication of the Rights of Women, the struggle for women to kind of claim their rights. And in the 19th century, it was very much kind of voting rights, right to education, the right to own property. That's pretty much where the thrust was. In our time, the right has been much more in the political arena, political legal arena. What are women's rights? So the ERA has become kind of the rallying call of this stream of feminism. And, the right to access to jobs and pay equity and the right for equal training and all of that. So, and often I think when you use the language of feminist, the liberal feminists have so kind of taken the agenda because as a culture, we are so strong in our claim for rights, political civil rights, that's sort of the overarching claim or identification that has been put to this. The critique that people bring to that kind of analysis or that stream of feminism is that it really does not critique the system at all. Women try to get their rights within the system but don't bring their own critique to it. So there's no sort of challenge to the overarching structures that are there. And it also has no class analysis. It's often women who have the luxury of some kind of economic freedom for whom other women, often women of color or of various nationalities, are working for them, who have the freedom to be out claiming their political rights. So, but in kind of bringing that critique, I would not at all want to challenge the fact that that's a legitimate pursuit. For political rights. A second stream of feminism is socialist feminism. And that's a little bit, harder to identify. You can have socialists who are feminists who are ideologically identified with socialism, or you can talk about socialists who see feminism as a way of organizing women for the class struggle. So it's not as kind of clear in a way, perhaps, as the liberal feminist, but the axis of analysis for socialist feminists is the economic arena, and their claim that economic independence is absolutely critical for women to have their own kind of freedom. That as long as women are dependent on men in a marriage situation or whatever, and do not have their own economic independence, they will never have the freedom to make their contribution. And I guess some of, you know, and then therefore the agenda of the socialist feminists have been to integrate women into the paid workforce and kind of pursue what opportunities are available and fight for, you know, getting women out of dead-end jobs and low-paying jobs and harassment in the workplace and discrimination against them in the workplace and, you know, and identifying that very much as kind of the oppression that women are under. This kind of stream of feminism, in a way, has freed, I think, a lot of women. You hear more and more stories of women who are, who would claim now to be, you know, to be living in marital situations that are absolutely deadly. You know, women who are being abused, physically abused, psychologically abused, living in situations to say, why would they continue? And the realization that for so many women, there's no economic alternative. They see no way to get out of that and be able to survive. So there's been a certain kind of, you know, the socialist feminists have offered a sort of a freedom for women to really see how economics is enclaimed within their, how it is controlling in their own life situation. The socialist feminists are very strong on women's reproductive role as central to their own analysis. And, you know, many of them, the stronger ones, would say that the system assures, you know, the way it is now, that women will continue to produce workers for the workforce. And unless you challenge the system, you know, that's all you're doing is maintaining that workforce. So they have a strong reproductive rights agenda, and you know, that whole language of I own my own body and I have a right to do with it what I will. Also, they have pushed for socializing many of the tasks that have been traditionally women's in the home. Child care, daycare centers, that kind of thing has been very much the socialist feminist saying that that's equally a man's task and to continue to identify that completely as women's role is an unfair division. So the economic then cut is their strength. A third group of feminists, I call them radical cultural feminists, come at the whole kind of feminist agenda from the axis of culture. And they point to the core issue of patriarchy as the overarching controlling reality that has so governed and so defined life for women. And I think one of the kind of, you know, as we even talk about this, what is often a misperception, it seems to me, when you're talking about feminism or women's struggle, is that this is, you know, this is kind of middle-class women pushing to have a better place for themselves. And what feminists are really saying is that as they look out from the experience of sexism, that they are the victims of that, just as peoples of color are the ones who talk to us about racism. That doesn't come out of white society, that comes out of peoples who suffer that. Women say if the experience of sexism demonstrates to us, first of all, how we in fact are denied our rightful place in the total order of things. Men also are denied the possibility of their full potential, and the total community is denied the richness, the potential that's there in this original design of male and female. What we live out of is a world that has been shaped exclusively by the male. That the and it's the kind of core definition of patriarchy that the male is normative. The male is normative. The men think, how men see, men's worldview, the way men structure reality, is what we all live by. And the growing, you know, realization that that is only half of the picture. And so women keep saying, our experience, our charism, our herstory, not our history, but herstory, our gift, our whole journey has remained outside of the public domain. In the private domain, in the home, yes. And women have their influence, there's no doubt about it. But in shaping institutions within which we live, the educational, the legal, the political, the economic, the ecclesial, the banking situation, nothing in that public domain reflects the experience and the charism that is woman. And that's the deepest criticism, you know, that the whole movement brings, and it's pinpointed in that word patriarchy. So for cultural feminists, or radical feminists, it's to liberate women from these forms of male control, wherever they're manifest. And to do that, and this is what's kind of really very hard, I think, in one way, there are two ways that women say they're going to do that. There's a separatist movement. Women who say they're the only way we can kind of get out from under this crust that we've lived in for millions of years, the only way we can break through that is to separate ourselves out and explore what it is really to be woman. And so the women's collectives and women's communes and an effort to say, I'm sorry, but for this time you men must stay away because we have to discover who we are. We don't know it. Because we have been so embedded in a culture, in systems that have been shaped by men. Now, as you, and I think you can say, you know, tactically, you can see that that has its merit. In the long run, it can't, it's not a viable method, a viable, you know, option in a way. But I'm very sympathetic to that. You know, that there is a way that women do not know. And very often, you know, it is women's experience that when we're in a mixed group, women will not speak up. Women will not. This morning, at the Bible session, we were as many women as men. Women have read the Bible as long as men have. Susan spoke, Carol said a few things, but other women, we will not, because in seven men, in a row, kind of define what it is that's in the book, or what we should be thinking about, or how we should ask the questions. Or, you know, so there is a very real claim to this. And you say, well, why not? Why don't you speak up? Because, for one thing, because, well, many different things, but one piece of it is that the way the argument has been shaped for so long, that as women try to bring their questions, they're not even heard. They come out of a different perception. And a lot of times they're just dismissed, and you have that happen often enough, and you learn to shut up. Secondly, you know, I just, it happened to bring along, this is a regular news thing that comes from the UN, and this one documents the illiteracy rates around the world. You know? And in every society, everywhere across the world, women have not the educational background. They have been denied those opportunities. The literacy, illiteracy rate, I'm sorry, nearly half of the adult women in developing countries, this is especially, but nearly half of them neither read nor write. Neither read nor write. And unless you can kind of put a name and put your reality out there so others can exchange in it, it's very hard for you to be in any kind of open form. So that there's a long history of why women say, you know, my voice has not been heard. And that's very real in the debate today. Now those three little, you know, synopses are very general. And I think women would say, I'm all of them, or I'm none of them, or I'm a piece of this, and I'm Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, so I'm a radical feminist. Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm a socialist feminist, that there's no pure categorization, but that's just, those are streams of the movement, and I think sometimes we get locked in saying, well, this is what it is, and it isn't only that, it's just a piece of it. out of that, what seems to be emerging today, and the word is maybe a little bit jargony and all, but it is a growing kind of coming together of women who are coming out of the cultural feminist stream, but identifying that patriarchy as this core kind of cause of their oppression is equally operative with nature. So this ecofeminism would identify patriarchy as the kind of core problem, linking both women and nature in a very real way. That's kind of one stream of the ecofeminist movement. And women are calling themselves ecofeminists today as they explore that more and more, the linkage between women and the earth. And that's very dangerous in one way, because there's a way that women being identified with nature has been to keep them, you know, to identified with nature, and therefore dismiss them as less and not really fully having the full potential. So it's a very tight road we walk in a way, but it would claim that both, as long as the domination of patriarchy reigns, neither the earth nor women have a chance. That would be the foundation state. As long as the domination of patriarchy reigns, neither women nor the earth have a chance. Other women are coming into the eco-feminist movement from religious, from nature-based religions. Women who are going back pre-Christian and exploring the kind of foundational religious urgings of people long before Christianity, long before organized religions were established. And finding that, you know, from the earliest times, the mystery that women presented. You know, it's hard for us even to think back at times, but peoples who had no idea where new life came. Men and women slept together, but no understanding at all that there anything went on that made it possible for the woman then to bear life. And here was this woman who was life in the community. And only she. And the early nature-based religions, you know, there was a reverence for woman out of fear, out of this mysterious power she had over life and death. And all of that was kind of put down and lost as religions became more formalized. So there's the whole kind of link to the goddess tradition, that there was a sacred female center in most of those early religions, and as the archaeological digs go on, that becomes more and more apparent. And often, like the, you know, there were sacred groves, the kind of the secret resource, kind of recessed places of nature where religious rituals were carried on, all of that very symbolically tied to women's bodies. And that mystery that was present there. So the early mythologies are another source of women coming into the eco-feminist movement. And thirdly, just, you know, women who've been in kind of the ecology movement who are becoming kind of more and more feminist, as it were. So those three kind of streams are women identifying themselves as ecofeminists, and they would claim four sort of basic claims that they would say. That first of all, there's a clear connection between the oppression of nature and the oppression of women. That those two go hand in hand. And secondly, the need to understand the nature and the cause of that. And that's where I see a lot more scholarship needed. You know, that there is really a need to understand how that linkage has been made very early on. And thirdly, a claim that feminist theory must have more of an ecological perspective. And fourthly, that the ecological problems must have a feminist viewpoint if we approach them that. Some of the women who are, you know, who have been writing about this and do it from very different slants. Susan Griffin's book, and some of you may know that, Woman and Nature, The Roaring Inside Her, is probably the one that was one of the first and broke the most kind of drastic ground, Woman and Nature, where she tried to look at this break between, or the coding that culture has laid on the kind of deep genetic strains that we all carry. And so she goes back and forth in her book between what culture has, how the historical journey has been carried on and culture has defined it, and what's going on underneath genetically, and women, the roaring inside her. And it's a wonderful, and then Carolyn Marchant's other book, The Death of Nature, those two are probably the two earliest ones that kind of brought it forward, this claim about women linked with nature. Rachel Carson, the woman who, you know, we kind of date the ecological movement from her book, The Silent Spring, 1962. She's the one who pointed to this, you know, destructive attack that humans have been having on the earth, and especially in the kind of chemical and its attack on the biology of the earth. So Rachel Carson would be a very key woman in this whole movement. One woman that we had hoped to come for these 2 weeks, Elizabeth Dodson Gray, has been doing a lot of work in this arena, and her book, Green Paradise Lost. I was hoping to meet with her because she claims even that by our language of talking about the earth as Mother Nature, that we are, even in that language, being anthropocentric. We are laying onto the earth our own naming, and in so doing, kind of say, well, you know, a mother would never let you down. Like, this mother will never give up on us. You know? She will nurture us. And not letting the earth be it, letting the earth be its own reality, its own self, and taking it as that, instead of having to kind of put our name on it. The question I would like to put to her is, as I read different myths and stories of the tribal peoples from early on, the understanding of the earth as mother has been part of that from the very beginning. So I would like to really raise that question with her, you know, like how would she answer native peoples who speak very much out of the earth as mother. Rosemary Ruther writing about it, but no matter what cut, you know, what vantage point they come at it, they would all say that patriarchy or this social myth system that has dominated both women and nature is where they would pinpoint the problem. And just to help us a little bit, when I say that, you know, like, what are the presuppositions when, you know, and I can, you know, like, you say patriarchy and all the men start to put their back up against the wall. But just to kind of tease those out a little bit, the presuppositions that our culture has been built on, that we would say have come out of the male cut, you know, the male mindset. First of all, that man, you know, the male human, is distinct from and superior to the remaining earth community. And we've talked a good bit about that along the way. But the separateness, you know, that man is superior to and distinct from the remaining earth community. Secondly, that man and man alone has the full potential of divine nature. You know, it's a very recent statement that man and woman equal in the potential of being created by God equal. You know, we've used the language, but in reality, woman has either been Eve, the temptress, the sensuous one, the one to be feared, to be kept away from the altar. She's either Eve or she's Mary. She's on a pedestal. She has to be better than anybody else. She cannot be just woman. Equal, walking in the path out of her own reality. Thirdly, These are all the patriarchal presuppositions, that the earth is not our true home, but is a corrupt, chaotic, mysterious, and dangerous place which must be dominated and controlled. and that has been institutionalized for us in many, very particularly in our ecclesial institutions, that the earth is a corrupt place. And I think that much of the fear, I would say, in my own little theory, that much of the fear, and I talk more in terms of like the Vatican, of all this creation spirituality, has something to do with its link with women, it's linked with sensuality, it's linked with fertility, it's linked with sex, it's linked with you cannot control it, you cannot control the earth. And therefore, how can we allow this kind of emergence of another stream that would challenge the hierarchical, the anthropocentric, the androcentric, that the male has the cut on reality. Fourth presupposition, the earth is akin to the female, and therefore not to be trusted or feared or separated from or controlled or whatever. And fifth, demonic associations are made with women and nature. Women's sexuality is corrupt. And there's a lot of, you know, there's, again, you go back, and a lot of this comes out of some of the earliest writings. I have found a book called The Creation of Patriarchy by Gerda Lerner, very, very helpful and insightful. And she goes back, you know, she starts 300 million years ago with the first emergence of the humanoid type out of the earlier mammal type, and tracks a lot of that. So that there really is just an immense amount of scholarship that's growing. And this is probably the one that, you know, we would recognize more in our own, that reality is dualistic by nature. The dualism that is in reality. And it's hierarchical. And so if I play out those dualisms, what do they sound like to you? Male, female, heaven, earth, spirit, matter, the mind, the soul over the body, culture over nature, immortal over the mortal, independence over interdependence, control over cooperation, active, receptive, rational, non-rational, authority, obedience. And every one of them, if we put those on a grid, would be the reigning culture. The reigning culture. And this the receptive, And the one questioned, and the one that is trying to make its voice heard in our world today. And lastly, the presupposition, I've already mentioned it, kind of, that the male experience is universal and absolute. Tom Berry names four establishments in the last 5,000 years that have controlled, that have kind of reinstated the male patriarchy. The classical empires have been built on the patriarchal model. The ecclesiastical establishment, built on a patriarchal model. The nation state, built on a patriarchal model. And the modern corporation. And within that overarching, overwhelming kind of load, women are trying to say, there is another way. There is another experience of life. There is another history. What thrills me is from an earlier day in the women's movement when most of our claims were statistical. You know, we had to get numbers. We had to demonstrate that what we were saying was actually an experience of numbers. We had to get that women. I often think that, you know, I go out the door in the morning to work, and I earn like 61 cents out of a dollar. And my husband Lou goes out the door to work, and he earns a dollar. You know, he earns 100, and I earn 61. I work as hard as he does, I think. I do my work equally responsible, simply because he's male. He has a cut, he has a resource available to him that's not available to me. Simply because he's male. And women have been trying to demonstrate in a lot of different numbers of how they treat. What I thrill at is the scholarship that's emerging in every field. You know, as women are demonstrating, how the differences are being experienced. Margaret Mead talked about in anthropology. She said, wherever she went, in the very simple islands, in the Pacific, or in any society, men and women did weaving and fishing. In some societies, women were the fisher people, and the men were the weavers. In other societies, women were the weavers, and the men did the fishing. But no matter what, in what society we're in, whatever the work the women did was less honored, had a less position in that social reality. So the work, it did not matter what the job was, it was who was doing it. Elise Boulding has written a tremendous book. It's called The Underside of History. It's a tome, really. And she has traced kind of women's story. And I was with her one time, and I said to her, Elise, where did you get the title for your book? And she said, I was sitting outside in the garden one day writing, and I just reached over and turned over a rock. And underneath the rock, she said, was this little moist area and grubs and all this little vital vitality going on in the region. And she said, for me, it was a perfect symbol of what I was discovering in my research, that under this rock, the underside of history that women have been living, that has been essential to the life of the society, but has not shaped that society. And and then she documents it in so many ways. There was one other point I wanted to make. It escapes me at the moment, but it's another example of something like that that I wanted to get. Anyhow, just let me wind up almost just in a few moments by saying that the three main contributions I would think that ecofeminism is bringing to both the feminist critique and the ecological movement is that very critical analysis of the patriarchal concept and thought processes, and the link then that has to be made between women and the earth. And a lot of the women who are active in like the environmental movement are raising that very same critique within the movement itself, that it's often the men who are claiming to speak for the movement, and women again struggling to have their experience and their insight brought to this. I know the other, just before I go on, the one other book that I heard reviewed and don't know the title of it, but it fascinated me. A collection of letters and diaries of women who traveled west with the earliest settlers. And in it, they document how, the history I learned about that was the experience of white people fighting the red people. The Indians, the native peoples were in our way, and we had to this continually battling with the natives and killing them and fighting all along. What they discovered in this woman, anyhow, in reading many of the early diaries, that women who had to feed the families moving west did not know how to use the local foods. And women established a whole different relationship with the native populations on the way going west. They had to learn what greens could they eat. They didn't know about corn. All the things that the native peoples who were in those areas had lived off of, the women had to establish those kind of relationships. And I just say, would our history, would the native peoples of this country be the most discriminated class of any group of people in this country if her story had played an equal role with history in telling that journey, defining it? I think we haven't a clue of what we've lost, because women have not had the chance to make their voice heard in the public arena. So that was the one other example. And if any of you know that book, or discovered, I would say it would be a wonderful way of helping us better understand what we have lost in them. A second contribution that I think the eco-feminist will bring is kind of reclaiming the feminine spiritual awareness of the sacredness, the wisdom, the interrelatedness of all of life. Something of claiming and reinserting that into the movement. And then I think, I find anyhow, that women are very, very much in that common search and a realization that, that the story that we live off of today is no longer adequate to our time. The search for, the struggle for a new story, a movement into, you know, a new way of understanding the future that lies before us. Two final little points. To dispel some of the critique that is often made, not only of the, you know, the feminist movement, but to dispel the kind of assumptions that it's the white women of the northern world that are the ones who are active in this and claiming this and stressing this. I just want to kind of share with you one little excerpt from an interview with a woman from India, Indian woman, who is a physicist, and you know, she's a very cosmopolitan woman. She's worked with the United Nations, but she's done a lot. She has not lost her rootedness in the local community where she grew up, and she lives in that part of India that borders the Himalayas. And one of the very active movements that has gone on now since the early 70s in the Himalayas, they call it the Chipko movement. You know about it, Jackie. Chipko in Hindi means to hug. And when the first loggers came into the regions along this, in this area of the Himalayas, the women ran to the trees and hugged them to stop the men, the loggers, from cutting down the trees. And this started a movement that continues today, you know, with more or less success. It's a little bit like the videotape we saw, the local peoples resisting this incursion of modern, in this case, the loggers moving in. But this, her name is Vandana Shiva, this woman, the physicist, and she's talking about her working with some of these local women and living with them in the villages and kind of sharing with them this experience of the Chipko movement. And she says she was walking with one of the women one day as they were kind of coming or moving towards, walking along the path, walking along the route. And she said to her, Shiva said to her companion, to this other woman, she said, you know, you're out in the fields during the day, you have to run to this when you hear the loggers coming. You've kept this up for years. How? Where do you get your energy? And the Hindi word for energy is shakti. Shakti. Where do you get your shakti? And this woman said to her, this very simple, uneducated, you know, these illiterate women that we can categorize that way, illiterate, walking with her said, can you see this grass growing along the side of the road? Do you see this? We come to cut this grass, and every year it grows back. And the shakti in that grass is the shakti in me. Do you see these trees growing? They're 200 years old. Every year we lop these trees to feed our cattle and keep our children alive so the children have milk. And still the trees keep growing, and they still keep nurturing them. And the shakti in those trees is the shakti in me. See this stream, she said. Every year the rain comes, and it could just run off every year. But these trees stay alive long after the rain goes, and they keep feeding us. This clear, sparkling water, better than anything you have in the city. We call it living water. Your water you get in the cities is dead. It comes from a tap. This living water gives me life. This is the water that gives me shakti. Now I say, when we have people who are in such a relationship that they are in their own sense of, and know it to be that, that the energy of the earth is what's giving them energy to rationalize, to stop this mad, you know, rush to destroy before we even know what the earth and what we're all about. I take hope. And so I want to end with a poem. I'll just end it, open it, really. This is a poem written by a contemplative sister, a sister, you know, who, a woman, a religious woman who spends her life praying, as we see it anyhow. Something she wrote back in 1980. And the poem is called Call, C-A-L-L, Call. There is a new sound of roaring voices in the deep. In the deep and light-shattered rushes in the heavens. The mountains are coming alive. The fire-kindled mountains moving again to reshape the earth. It is we, sleeping women, waking up in a darkened world, cutting the chains from off our bodies with our teeth, stretching our lives over the slow earth, seeing, moving, breathing in the vigor that commands us to make all things new. It has been said that while the women sleep, the earth shall sleep. But listen, we are waking up and rising, and soon our sister will know her strength. The earth moving day is here. We women wake to move in fire. The earth shall be. Deepest experience of life is relationship, and then that becomes her moral criterion. It's not what does the law say is right or wrong, but what does this relationship dictate to me of the rightness and wrongness of my action? Relationship with God, relationship with earth, with other people, the relationality. And I'm very struck that that language is moving so much into our more Dan was using it this morning, the words of empowerment. A lot of the concepts that have, you know, I've been very kind of central to women's scholarship are emerging into more popular, you know, they're just kind of breaking out in different ways. And then the second step from that work of Carol Gilligan is the second book, Jerry, I know you've seen it. It's called Women's Ways of Knowing, written by four women psychologists. And they're documenting, you know, that there is a climate that within which women learn much better than other climates. There's a setting that makes it possible for women to learn that is not the kind of traditional classroom master over all sorts of information coming from one center. I'm not exhibiting that very well this afternoon at all in this setting. But that there is a much different setting, and that voice, and that's the most fascinating part of the title of the book is somewhere in here, Women's Ways of Knowing. You know, here it is, Women's Ways of Knowing, the Development of Self, Voice, and Mind. And when they first started their research, they wanted to know how women got the identification of who they were, their own self-identification. So it was self and mind. And the more they interviewed women, the more they heard that the language of voice was kept coming back again and again and again. Women saying, they never heard me. I tried to speak, but it wasn't the language speaking. I was being silenced. I wasn't being heard. Nobody was really listening. I couldn't really talk. Words were used as weapons against me. I was feeling deaf and dumb. I was having no words. I couldn't say what I meant. You know, the whole kind of voice mechanism became very apparent to them as they started doing their more. So they included then another whole segment in the book on voice. So the total title of it, Women's Ways of Knowing, Development of Self, Voice, and Mind. And that was just so fascinating to me. And you know, like, if you are in any audience, often
you cannot hear women. Like in the churches when we have prayers of the faithful, you know, we invite women to speak. How many times you can't hear? Because women have not been trained to speak in the public domain. We don't even have the, we haven't had generations of that training to speak out. So we don't even have the vocal cords to do that. As a rule, surely there are exceptions, and I'm making great generalizations. Some women
don't. Well, I hear about half of what women say in our common prayer.
Yeah, you don't hear it. And some of it is because women hesitate to say. We often begin by apologizing. This may not apply, but what do you think about this? We often do it because we feel very unsure in the public domain.
That's more than, also as well as being unsure, it's being labeled. It's so easy if a woman has any strength at all to be labeled a witch or a bitch.
Yeah, right.
Either one of those. And if a woman is powerful and knows she's powerful or has powerful thoughts, a way to compensate is to have a gentle voice and to apologize either before or after speaking, or to in some way make it a little, make it innocuous. Well, you know,
this
may or may not see it this way. I may be wrong, and that comes before or after almost everything a woman says. And I think there are ways of handling that fear of being labeled witch or bitch, or strong woman, which has in most people's minds a negative connotation.
Or is it just a clearer view of reality? I mean, you may be wrong, whereas when a man says something, it's true.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, that's the point. They, you know, your reality is not equally accepted in the public domain.
I remember when I read that book, I was very struck by that, the section on the silent woman.
Yes.
And how it's, you can't go from being a silent woman to having a full voice. There was definitely
stages of it.
Yeah, a process or a progression. And there's a lot, I remember, gosh, it's been a few years, but the woman who just didn't know what she thought, or she always said what her father said, or, you know, she, issues were just handed down through the family or through her husband or whatever the media said. She had never really, she spoke and she had friends and she wasn't silent, she was very verbal, but when she's looking at, when what she said was written down and looked at, she just was a mimic. And she had no idea what she thought about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought the book did a very good job
of identifying the stories that they did.
The story, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the spiritual overlay of ecofeminism and the desire of ecofeminists to come up with a new story instead of the Judeo-Christian patriarchal story, and you know what that means for Christians.
Well, I think when I'm drawing on one woman in a lot of that, and when she says it, she's also talking about a new cosmology, you know. A new place of the human in the total, kind of in the evolutionary stream. She's a student of Tom Berry, so she's using his analogy there. Susan, Jackie, Mary. Sally, Linda, lots of voices, Heidi.
I guess there's a voice inside me that wants to say, and it probably has something to do with my generation, look how far we've come, and be sensitive to men who are very supportive. Mm-hmm. Those are two things.
Good. Look how far we come. That's a very good comment. Because a lot of younger women have no idea. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that would be good to hear. As even
And you know what? The bell rang. So truly, I mean, yeah, but if people want to, well, it just, you know, like, younger women today have no idea even of the struggle to kind of do things that even in my life I've seen, you know, like, so that there's a way that how far we've come even in this modern, from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know. Some of you born, what, when? 60s, late 50s, like, you know, a lot of the early work, you're beneficiaries of it now, that thing, as we are of what women have done before us. And then also, like, to try to be inclusive in this whole debate, discussion, so that the men who really want, who would say, yes, I am a feminist, you know, and mean that with all their heart and soul, and want to learn it, along with us, you know. Let us invite you out.
I was reading this book by a German leader in the Green Movement, and he brings out what I come to think is a very important point, which is the female and the male in all of us.
Yeah.
And the males are subordinates of the female. Some men are in some ways more female than they are male. And there's that possibility of letting it come out.
But
I don't know what sense that makes to you, you know, the animus and the animosity.
Very much, Al. In fact, that's what I meant in saying the kind of three injustices. It's an injustice to woman, it's an injustice to man, to the male.
And I did want to read what he said.
As well as to the total community.
Because here's a male saying that he's really advocating the female direction, that the male spirituality and its energy is directed toward expansiveness, progressiveness, and upward. World appropriation by masculine kindness toward heaven, away from earth. Those are the images. And the female is backward and downward toward the origin in the mother's womb and the earth toward nature. I think it's interesting. And he of course is advocating the female, in the face of the pretty much completely, as I read this book, in the face of the modern ecological crisis.
Well, I think, women would say they have a cut on the reality that has not had its chance in the public domain, that's all. And, you know, often when you say that, then people say, well, look at Margaret Thatcher, is that what you want? You know? Is that what you want? Or Indira Gandhi, or whatever, you know? And no, of course not. And it's a question of strategy then. Like the people who say, if there's no way of, it's the same question I think about women's ordination. Some women saying, indeed, I want to be ordained, so that from within, we can collectively make change. And other women saying, there's no way, I want to be ordained into that as it is, and I'm going to fight from the outside. You know?
But the two issues, one is participation in the male world,
yeah,
and the other is embodiment of a female dimension of reality.
But how do you get that in? You know, how do you even bring that into the forum to debate unless you're accepted around the table? You know, that's one argument, that if you don't get your foot in the door. And so, you know, women are saying, we've got to get in Congress, we've got to be in those positions that are now controlled by, and not everyone who walks, not every woman certainly calls herself a feminist or would even identify with this as an agenda. Not at all. You don't presume just because you're a woman you have this agenda. Or because you're a man that you don't have it.
This author seems to suggest that the males who have this tendency and a female should withdraw. They you mentioned that strategy before. Mm-hmm.
Mary Daly would be, I think, identified as, she would say, it's not redeemable.
Well, it's, I mean, she teaches at a college, and she lives in...
There's nothing pure about any of this. There's no way you can be pure. It's an ambiguity on all sides. But I think if like, you know, something about you take your steps in light of something you understand and you see, and therefore you're trying to make the change that you think is the one, you're moving in the direction of what you believe has to happen. Well, at least you're taking an informed step.
I think there's some really fascinating issues that personally I don't feel we have a lot of clarity to, and that is that there's the, you know, maybe it's because I think about these issues a little differently. There's the issue of sexism, which is excluded, like racism, women from equal participation. But I would suggest that if we were to somehow magically able to achieve that, that would not bring us any closer to resolving the issue of patriarchy and matriarchy. That one does not suppose the other. That women, even though they are more relationally oriented, as you suggested, will not necessarily bring resolution to that issue. Because patriarchy can be both positive and negative, and as matriarchy can be both positive and negative. Matriarchy can be as negative as patriarchy. Feminine, the negative side of the feminine can be as destructive as the negative side of the masculine.
Would you give us a chance?
I don't think I want to give the negative side of the feminine any more chance than we want to. We've already seen what the negative side of the masculine is. And that's what we're trying to recover from in our time. And I don't think we have clarity about that issue in the writing.
Good, Scott. I your point that sheer numbers is not going to necessarily make a change. I think that's very valid. No, that's not. But I would say that the kind of exploratory track that I think this, you know, that for instance the ecofeminist would be pursuing is much more trying to get underneath the culture and come closer to the genetic base or the nature base. I think their pursuit of that, they have more invested in that, they're closer to that, that's the kind of more in tune direction that women are pursuing and would come closer to to revealing than what is available or what has been or the experience that has come out of the male mind, the male worldview.
It seems to me any time we experience. Pursue a track in either the feminine pole or the masculine pole, we end up with a power conjunction. And then until we get to some kind of androgynous position, we're going to be at war. think the masculine and the feminine are going to be at war with each other.
Okay.
And what we need is a love conjunction of the two. And it's like you don't correct one evil by suggesting another.
No, but I don't. But I'm wondering if you raise it, you know, if you cast it in the language of love, then are you not dealing with, you know, is that inserting then kind of a another, like, a spiritual or a theological or a religious context when we haven't come to grips with something that's much deeper, you know? And for instance,
I'm just trying to wake us up here.
Yeah, right. Right. I can see that. And maybe
I would rather respond in some ways to the mere fact that you framed it the way you did. In some ways, it's almost a patriarchal view of looking at the two in a dualistic way, which would not be how a feminist sort of view would even begin to frame the situation. But there would be matriarchy and patriarchy, and they would collide at some point in power. Cast it in the light that's patriarchy itself, if you get what I'm saying.
It could be, although the person that I learned the concept from is a woman.
But just like all the men, I mean, we have to say some man is speaking for the men's movement in the same way, just because she was female, she was speaking for the women's movement. But I'm waking myself up too.
Okay. I think it's really interesting to ask what happens. If you've got a patriarchy, what's happening to the matriarchy? Because I don't think it just doesn't exist. I think it goes underground. And is equally as controlling within a different position. And that's from my analysis, psychological analysis of any culture, is either a ruling patriarchy, and also an equally powerful matriarchy, only the matriarchy is not underground. And it could be real destructive.
But the issue between patriarchy and matriarchy is not a matter of control, it's a matter of substance as well. Equally important, if not more important, is the substance of life. If I hear the discussion.
It seems you're bringing up that dualism again, too, between patriarchy and matriarchy. And is that a male way of thinking, always in dualism?
Think dualistic, rather than, say, thinking relationally. Is that the point you're
making? Yeah, I think that's right.
I don't think we really know all of it. I'm trying to follow some of this, but until we just lived in an open environment where there was full expression, then we could experience the sort. But I'm not sure we're close to that situation. Seems to me that would be the ideal. So much of it, from what I hear you saying, is unknown yet, because there's been such a lack of full expression.
Of the possibilities, you mean?
Jen, can you say something about getting closer to the genetic base?
Yeah.
As opposed to sort of a cultural genetic coding.
Yeah.
Who we are.
Yeah. That's certainly what you know, where I I can't say an awful lot, except that, you know, that there are things we know that we no longer recognize or allow to be a part of us and our debate, that come out of our story of coming out of the earth. And, you know, and we have laid on that cultures and cultures and cultures, and many of those determined, you know, purely out of the male half, and so we've lost our touch. We're not outraged anymore. We don't feel that we've been torn out of our rightful place in a lot of ways when we know we really have, you know. We look at a mountain gutted, and we don't recognize that that's me being gutted. You know, that's part of me. Because I have come out of that earth. And that's the sense of what I mean by that, Mike, and I can't say a lot more.
You said that in some ways there's something written in our genetic code that we've not honored or...
We no longer honor it. We did. We had to earlier. We had to, because we lived much more in dependence upon and relationally and you know. But gradually, and they say the first kind of, you know, agricultural cutting into the earth and certainly not all bad, but that was a very dramatic development in the unfolding story, and a kind of a separation and a break. But what I fear at times, like in this, is that, you know, it begins to sound just so romantic and unconnected to anything that we know, that we are, and see any way to grope with it, but I just sense there's a truth there that has to be pursued. That's all I, you know. And where it leads us then is like you're saying, I don't think we have a clue.
Well, it has, don't you think, though, that there's a lot more value placed on the values than you're lifting up today? I mean, it seems to me there's a definite movement in that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had that marvelous scheme, the dualistic scheme, rational, non-rational.
And nobody wants to be in the side anymore.
Yeah. There's a movement,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Where it wasn't very long ago where, you know, non-rational was kind of like a dirty word.
Yeah.
There's a little bit there. But now there's, you can talk about being involved with non-rational things and people, you know, right? So don't you think
the soft males of the 80s. Well, but because women have pushed for it. That's my claim. You know, it has come because women have said, hey, I'm not going to, you know, we're not going to stay outside of this, or how come you're doing this, or, you know, we have raised our voices in opposition and kind of making a case for that feelings are a part of what it is to be human. So if a man cries, I mean, what chance would a political leader in our country have today if he publicly cried?
Well, in Australia, I think it's wonderful. The Prime Minister cries on television every
terrific! That's that world down
because they're recognising that a woman's vote is worth a lot more now, especially now that they're out of the homes, because before, most of the women, when they were voting, they were so influenced by radio and newspaper, because that was the only outside connection they had with what was happening, and of course that was all conservative, and so they thought that was right, whereas we all know that the media doesn't always give both sides to the story. And so now they're out in the workforce. The vote is changing, and because there's more women in Australia now, the parties have to think about it. So, So ours cries all the time.
He's using it as a political tool.
Yeah. My daughter's on drugs, oh, that's really terrible. Oh, poor old Bob, we better let him have another term. Yeah.
And I would say even though there may be a start on opening up, I still find it terribly difficult. I find it very difficult to have a voice without having gone through a system where I have to jump through male hoop after male hoop. I think Colette Dowling, she decides a study of in schools and stated that kindergarten is very oriented towards the feminine side of being and way of doing things, very highly relational. And as we move through the educational system, it becomes more and more less relational, more and more abstract, and in many ways more and more male. So I find myself in a situation where I'm dealing with dualism and at best dialecticism in theology. You know, in trying to state a case, I try to come up with images which are more from my feminine side of being. And images are the only vehicle I can find to state what I want to state, which is, in my case, the relational side of ethics and a more multidimensional approach to making moral decisions. And I know, I have a sense, that I will not be heard because, for one thing, ethics still cannot, most ethicists cannot step out of that dialecticism or dualism. And what I say will be placed within that continuum between one point and another point. And I will be placed in one camp. Well, I know which camp I'll be placed in. And shot down. Or the other criticism will be that what I'm doing is not scholarly enough. You know? And so I've been trying to push against this, you know, real weight of, well, how can my voice be heard? How can I say what I think is groundbreaking in ethics? Mm-hmm. How can I say it in such a way that this vastly male-dominated system will hear what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I know that if I finish what I'm doing, one of two things will happen. Either it'll be considered groundbreaking or it'll be completely, you know, it will not be heard because it's not scholarly enough. And my questions have been, well, if I read enough books, if I have a long enough bibliography, you know, my initial bibliography was 90 works long. You know, if it's long enough, is that going to make it scholarly enough? If I read, how much of Bart do I have to read? He's written 1,000 pages on ethics, 12,000 pages in his Church Dogmatics, you know. How much, and any male doing a thesis would have to deal with a lot of the same questions about being scholarly and academically adequate, but I find I have the added baggage of trying to say what comes, I know, from a woman's perspective, you know, and throwing that into an arena that can't hear it. And I also have this feeling that the last thing I can do if I want to be heard is to relate it all to feminism, because that's what the issue is largely related to. Mm-hmm. If I bring that in. It just opens up another bag of worms, and also touches something that men fear, and so it'll be even less likely to be heard.
I think that's changing, though, because I just did graduate work in theology, and the hermeneutic, or the way the biblical interpretation that the different focuses they use, they definitely use Fiorenza and some of the feminist, you know, brilliant scholarly work by feminist scholars, I think is definitely a part of any, well, maybe not any, but
no,
increasingly
not
a lot.
In my, probably there are 50% women studying with you, and I was in seminars where I was the only woman with 11 men. And there are 5 men to every woman, so it's a different context too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially. Yeah, that is true. Women have done a lot more in biblical studies because it's more related to the concrete and to images and to literature than they have done in systematics or more abstract psychology.
It was triple, isn't it? Yeah.
I just need a couple. Sure, there's another book. Boost.
Oh, well, this is pretty good. Yeah, salad.
Do you have that?
Yeah.